Welcome to the Transformational Wealth Podcast with Mark Henn. Mark is devoted to helping you understand how the wealthy invest and explaining how to leverage investment strategies to make the most of your financial situation. In each episode, Mark breaks down key financial strategies and provides direct action steps so you can expand your financial toolkit and change the trajectory of your financial life. He also sits down with individuals who are actively using these wealth-building power plays, giving you real-world insights into how these strategies work in action. Are you ready? Let's jump in and start building your financial future today.
Welcome to the Transformational Wealth Podcast. I'm Mark Henn, your host, CEO of Harvest Financial Advisors. And I'm thrilled to have Alyssa Miller joining us today to talk about real estate. Again, this series of podcasts is connected with my new book, Power Plays of the Wealthy. We talk about the five super asset classes, one of those being real estate. And while there's lots of opportunities, different areas to go into real estate, I wanted to kind of showcase and talk to Alyssa. We have a little history in terms of knowing each other, being neighbors for a period of time as well. And I think she has a great story of how she got started that speaks to how, you know, anybody can get started as well. So Alyssa, thanks for joining us today.
So happy and honored to be here.
Well, thanks. So we, as I mentioned, we go way back. The first time I met Alyssa is when she moved in to a house next door to us here in a lovely area of Cincinnati, and got to know her and found out that we were both fellow Boilermakers. So we both graduated from Purdue. What was your degree even in?
Psychology, sociology, minor in English.
How much have you used that in your maybe in your business? Yeah,
maybe the abnormal psychology part with the tenants,
right?
A little bit, maybe.
right.
But I learned a lot outside of the classroom as I did inside of the classroom.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to jump right in here then. So here you are, you graduate from Purdue, you have this degree, but I guess real estate was probably already in your blood a little bit, right?
No.
It wasn't. Oh, wow.
So I had wanted to be a school psychologist. I was going to Purdue for that purpose.
Sure.
And my junior year, I interned with one, and it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. So I switched majors, trying to figure out what I was going to do. And ultimately, I graduated and didn't have a strong plan going forward. I was bartending at the time, and I was making more money bartending than I would have been able to use my degree.
Sure.
And I was like, I can't bartend the rest of my life. So
right.
I had about a year after graduation where I was trying to sort my life out and figure out my direction. And
okay.
It was during this year that I was living in Indiana. I came back home to Cincinnati and was hanging out with my parents. And my dad said, "Hey, I want to go to a real estate meeting tonight. Are you interested in coming with me and learning something about real estate?" Now, he had a couple rentals in the 80s.
Okay.
When I was, you know, in elementary school. I had no idea what he was doing.
Sure.
And he sold everything when they changed the tax laws in 86.
87. Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
You reference it in your book. But he sold his five properties, and he didn't do anything in real estate since then. So
okay.
We're talking like this is like 1999, maybe.
All right.
So I said, yes, I like hanging out with my dad. I'll go to this real estate. So there's 22-year-old me in this real estate meeting. And the speaker says, "I can show you how to make $5,000 to $10,000 in 2 weeks with no money and no credit." And I was like, no money, no credit,
right.
Is this for real?
Right.
And he laid out a basic plan of how you do that. And it was ultimately a strategy in real estate we call wholesaling. And I was kind of hooked after that meeting. How much can I learn is what I wanted to know. I had never bought a house before. I was a renter. I didn't know how mortgages worked. I didn't know depreciation, right. write-offs. I didn't know any of it. I just said, right. I would like to have a lump sum of money with no money and no credit. So we decided to go into real estate. Now, my father was 50 when we started. He had a much different plan than lump sums of money. He said we should build up cash flow. I would like to have cash flow. So we had very different, just the nature of where we are, where we're in our lives, different ideas of what we were trying to accomplish. And he was looking towards retirement and in the future and wanted to have passive income coming in. And I wasn't looking for that. So we bought our first property in January of 2000. And we were originally going to wholesale that. That was our original strategy. We came, you know, middle-class family. I didn't have a ton of money. I didn't have credit. I didn't have experience. I don't even think I had bought my own car at that point, you know, so it was, I didn't have much. And he had a little bit more experience than I did, but we weren't coming from a place of tremendous wealth and money to spend on this stuff. So we were going to hold.
You didn't have a vast history, as you said, a vast history of knowledge. Anyway, you're just getting started.
Correct. I had none, and he had just a little bit. And
a little bit.
Went, you know, he had bought a rental and then turned it over to a property management company. So he was pretty hands off with the investments he had had in the past.
Okay.
So we were going to start with wholesaling so that we could build up our cash reserves. Right. Now, the very first house that we were able to get under contract that was a good deal, we had a handful of highly experienced investors coming to us saying, we want to buy this deal from you. We want to buy this deal from you. And we were like, great. We kind of looked at each other and we're like, well, if it's this good of a deal, maybe we should keep it and fix it and sell it ourselves. So we did that. We sold it 72 days later, within 4 hours of hitting the MLS for more than full price offer. And it ruined me. That experience ruined me for the rest of my life.
Cause it was never easy. That easy again.
It was never, now I still 25 years later, I list something. And if I don't have showings and an offer within like 6 hours, I'm like, what's wrong?
That's right.
Yeah. So, but that's how we started. And that was our first project. And we went on to do wholesaling after that. We still did wholesaling. We did a few more fix and sells. We did get into rentals after that, mainly because we messed up on the fix and sells. And when you can't sell something, you've overpaid or overinvested in holding and renting is your next option. So that's how we kind of got into plan B was holding and renting. That's how we got into rentals. And then 2008 happened, 2009, market crashed, everything got ugly. And it was coming out of that our rental business really exploded.
I'm going to stop you right there. Cause I want to get to that rental side of the business and look at that. You made a very interesting comment that if you fix it up, if you can't sell it, then you go to the rental side of it as well, because you're not going to get the money you want out of it. But before that, I don't talk about wholesaling in the book. We talk a lot about, you know, commercial and residential real estate, the benefits there, the tax advantages and so forth. Explain a little bit what wholesaling looks like.
Sure. So wholesaling is a person goes out, inspects the house, finds the house, negotiates the deal and gets the contract together. And ultimately they're going to sell that contract to the investor who's going to buy the property and do the work or hold it and rent it. And you get paid for the negotiation of the deal is ultimately what you're getting paid for your work for. And you can do these things with no money and no credit because you're not ultimately buying the house. So you don't need financing and the cash. You're just negotiating the deal.
So ultimately, you're the one that is supposedly has the experience to go out and value what you think the home is worth or what you'd be willing to pay for it before another investor finds it, correct? And then you negotiate the deal that you're going to find another investor basically, and then you put it out to other investors. You're going to tack on an additional amount of money, $5,000, whatever, for the investor. And that's where you make your money in a wholesaling deal, correct?
Correct. So if I know an investor is going to pay me $100,000 or would pay $100,000 for this particular house and its condition, I am going to negotiate a purchase price of 92.
Right.
And so I can say, here's the house for $100,000. You have to pay me $8,000 for the ability to buy it at 92.
Right. So what gave you the courage, experience, the knowledge to go out and value those properties to be able to assess that for that? What you thought an investor may pay for it? How did you get that knowledge?
I think there's kind of two pieces that you need to know when you're evaluating. Okay. You need to know what the property is worth after X amount of repairs are done.
Right.
And you need to know how much X amount of repairs are going to cost.
Right.
So the after repaired value was easier for me to learn. And that was a lot of time spent on the internet looking at MLS listings and seeing what are fixed up properties selling for in certain neighborhoods. That information's out there. It's free for the public. Zillow has made things so much easier. They didn't have Zillow in 2000.
Right.
So the wealth of information that's out on the internet now on how to learn this stuff is so much more than what I had to work with back in
sure.
the day. So it's fairly easy to determine what they're selling for. Now, when you're looking at what they're selling for, you need to see, you know, how far did these what condition are these fixed up properties
right.
selling in? So if all of them have garages and yours doesn't have a garage, you need to account for that, you know?
Right.
If all of them have granite countertops and you put a laminate countertop in your house, that's not going to be appropriate because everything else is selling with granite. So those are kind
gotcha.
Of some of the nuances that you're trying to figure out.
So almost like a real estate agent, for the listeners out there that might have purchased or sold a home, almost like a real estate agent would put together some comparables of what the values of homes are in the area. You're kind of scouring the listings, but you're looking in detail at some of these homes, right? What all the way down to what countertops are there and so forth. So
yeah,
go ahead.
You can look at the pictures. You can just look through
yes.
the pictures that are online and see.
Right.
what these houses look like on the inside.
And I guess if you had like a model home in that area that had no defects, it would be very easy to then value the one you want to buy compared to that. But it's not that way. So you have to, everyone you're looking at, most of the things I assume are going to be the same, but you have to look at what the differences are. Could there be damage to the outside as well that needs to be repaired on this home? And then does your home have that or not? So it's really just spending time and looking at those things and really kind of jumping in putting the time in, I guess.
I think all of real estate is going to boil down to two things, putting the time in and who
right.
do you know and networking. So if you don't have the experience or education to determine what the fixed up value is, make friends with a realtor. And maybe, you know, maybe because you're not buying a house, they're not getting paid on commission. Maybe you can say, hey, can I just give you like $10 for every house I need comped? And you can prepare that prepare that package for me. What do you think it would be worth?
Wow.
If you don't have the experience to estimate repairs, make friends with a contractor and say, hey, can I have you come walk this house with me and give me your estimates on what it would cost labor and material to take it to this level? And
right.
nobody is going to do this endlessly for free for you. So that's what I suggest. Maybe pay a little bit here, pay a little bit there, or, you know, trade services, you know, hey,
right.
you know, I'm willing to work an open house for you or put up neighborhood signs if you can, you know, get me comps.
Oh, wow. So going the extra mile there. So like, again, for the real estate agent, hey, you come to these comps, I pay you a little bit, but I'm willing to work an open house for you on a Saturday or Sunday because you don't want to sit there. That's interesting.
Correct. I like to offer those options when I talk to people because I started at 22 with no money. So
right.
you're
right.
telling me to pay a realtor with what? With what do I
right.
pay a realtor? With time. So your time can be, don't forget that that's a, you know, exchange of value.
Well, and it's a concept that I talk about on another podcast. I reference it. There's a great book by Dan Sullivan called Who Not How. Mm-hmm. And it talks about the idea that I don't have to figure out how to do everything, especially if it's not my area of expertise or I don't get a lot of energy out of it. But who do I know that I can bring in to assist? So if I have a contractor, I have to know some, you know, I have to recognize what's wrong, but the idea of what it costs and so forth, if I can find a who to come in and address that with me, I can get the expertise I need to help set this up and structure it as well. So that networking, as you referenced, is a very important piece of having different people there with expertise that you may not have to help you in that process.
That's exactly correct.
So even a little bit of, I mean, if there is a little bit of relational energy that has to be put out as well, besides just the energy of looking at the internet. So if you were somebody that wanted to just sit in your house and never talk to anybody, that may be a disadvantage to you then if you're not willing to make those connections with people.
It could be done. It would be another level of hurdle.
Yeah. Mm. And so then, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we learned through COVID how to do everything from home online. So it can be done, making phone calls, talking to realtors, getting, you know, sending emails. So it can be done.
Well, I also don't talk about a lot about flipping either. And that's a term that's thrown out a lot that I probably even has some magical aura around it as well. I hear people throw around the word, I'm going to flip this. I'm going to flip that. And it sounds so easy, but the next step, and correct me if I'm wrong, from a wholesaling standpoint, is if you decide to keep it, as you mentioned, and then improve it yourself, and then you sell it. So you actually have to have money to be able to put into it. And that might be where if you have a contractor that's willing to look at it and you say, hey, I'm going to actually fix this up. Would you come do the work? That's a way to pay them back as well to help with that. That would be considered a flip. Sure. And so tell me a little bit about that, the joys and maybe some of the pitfalls of flipping that you've done in the past.
I would say some of the joys are the check when you finally get to closing.
That's right. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
That's why we do it.
That's right.
You can make some very good money doing fix and sells. The hurdles are almost always the contractors. Finding reputable contractors that can do a good job, knowing how far to improve a house.
Right.
So as I'm talking countertops earlier, if you're in a neighborhood and it's all granite and you put in Formica, you're not selling that house for what you think you're selling it for. If you are in a neighborhood that's all Formica and you put in granite, you are not getting the return on that house that you think you are.
Right.
So that's the juggling with that.
Has that been on your shoulders then to when the contractor comes through to say, I know the homes in this area, going back to the countertops, I know the homes in this area have Formica, put, you know, do Formica or granite. Is that typically on you then to reference those things, or just know that if they come back with that to say, no, we're not putting in granite, I'm putting in Formica because everything else is Formica. What's your responsibility in that or role?
It is largely on you. And I have found that oftentimes contractors will want to upsell you work. They want more work. So they're going to ask to do more work, and putting in a granite countertop is going to, you know, generate them more income than a Formica countertop.
Sure.
One of the suggestions, if you're new at this and learning, would be to maybe you partner with that contractor and say, we're going to do this together and we'll split the profits at the end. So then the contractor is profit motivated to do it on time, to do a good job, to not put too much into the house, because they're going to make profit on the end as well.
Right. And when you say don't put too much into the house, I want to reference this. This is not about cutting corners to get away with something. It's just representing, I want to build the house up to the value, to the point of where it should be in connection to what the neighborhood looks like as well.
Absolutely.
So it's creating
terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. So I appreciate
it. You can also underimprove a house. You can totally underimprove a house. And right. you're not going to, you have to find that sweet spot of making it look like every other house in the neighborhood.
Right, right. And again, that probably just takes time or connecting with other people for that have that expertise as well, or continuing to learn for yourself. What are some of the resources, books, subscriptions, RIA? What are some places that an investor can really continue to learn and grow in their knowledge in this area?
You had mentioned RIA. That's the right. Real Estate Investors Association. I cannot speak highly enough of these groups that are throughout the country. There's city organizations, there's state level organizations, there's national conferences that get put on. And for the most part, especially if you can find a nonprofit one, there are profit ones and there are nonprofit ones. If you can find a nonprofit one, that organization is typically going to be filled with people that are very generous with sharing their life expertise, their suggestions, their contacts. And, you know, that's the meeting that I went to when I got started. And I still lean on my real estate investor connections. My window guy went MIA this past week. And I'm like, I've used this guy for 10 years and now he's ghosting me. So I call somebody I met at RIA that I know is doing turns and flips. And I said, do you have a window guy you can share with me? And lo and behold, they do. And now I have a trusted, verified contractor and I'm back on track.
Oh, wow.
So I can't speak highly enough for that. All sorts of partnerships. You're going to, you know, be able to find deals. You're going to find contractors, find money. We haven't gotten to the money part. How do you finance these? Most of that I lean on through the RIA organizations. As far as the how-to, there's so much on the internet. You can watch YouTube videos on how to inspect houses. You can watch YouTube videos on how to talk to sellers. And that's just, you know, free information that's out there and incredibly helpful. I would caution against buying boot camps. You can totally spend $20,000 if you want to on how to learn how to fix up a house. You don't need to, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Don't spend $20,000 on a boot camp and a mentor that's going to show you how to do this. Because you're going to get the information for probably $20,000 more than you would need to spend getting it.
So, and I've seen that where you have a lot of people out there, they write books, they start organizations, you go and they bring you in and this real estate thing is information is for free, but they give you enough to try to get you excited to go to the next level boot camp, as you point out. And they might even have some plants in the audience where they say, you know, the first five that sign up, blah, blah, blah. So they have two people that jump up and run back because they act all excited as well, just to get you to those more expensive boot camps. But what I hear you saying is that pretty much all the information you can get for free, because there's a lot of people, and that's what I've heard as well and experienced, there's a lot of people, especially in those nonprofit RIAs, that really want to help out. They're generous with their time, and there's so many resources online as well that you can put that information together without having to pay that $20,000 boot camp.
100% correct.
So before we go on, this episode of the Transformational Wealth Podcast is sponsored by Harvest Financial Advisors, a team of seasoned professionals committed to helping clients grow, protect, and enjoy their wealth. Whether you're building wealth, planning for retirement, or looking for smart investment strategies, our team is here to guide you every step of the way. Visit harvestadvisors.com to learn more. And now let's dive back in with a little bit more real estate conversation with Alyssa. You mentioned before 2000. So before 2008, I'm going to separate these two periods of time. Prior to 2008, were you doing predominantly wholesaling or flipping and a little bit of renting, an even mixture? What did that look like prior to that, do you think?
Prior to the fall, we were doing wholesaling. We were doing fix and sells, flipping, and we were doing a strategy called sandwich land contracts or sandwich financing. It's a little bit more sophisticated of a term, but I would find sellers who needed to sell and secure seller financing. So I would take over their mortgage, and then I'd find somebody that wanted to buy, but maybe didn't have the credit or needed a year or so to work on their credit to be able to buy. And I would sell to them on financing.
Okay.
And then in a year or two, they would refinance out and I would get paid in for putting the deal together. Ultimately.
Gotcha. Okay.
So
all right.
We did quite a bit of that. So when the fall happened and people were not able to get financing,
right?
That was ultimately kind of what impacted my business, is that I couldn't sell anymore because people weren't buying. They weren't getting financing. People weren't able to refinance out of these sandwich land contracts, and everything kind of went, you know.
And that's something at that point you could have said, well, we can't do it, but we can't do it the way we've done it before. And you keep trying to do it the way you've done it before, and it just didn't work. But the ability to be flexible, to learn and so forth, kind of led you down then, I guess, a different path. So tell listeners, just how did you progress through 08, 09, 10? How did your business start to change? And what did you try some things that didn't work? And ultimately, what were things that did work?
I think for a little while, it took us a little while to realize fixing and selling is not what we're going to be able to do right now. I think especially when you've got a good thing going and it starts to come to an end, it's easy to think, oh, this is just a blip. And in a couple months, I'll be able to do this. Or in 6 months, the market will be different. Or when no, things have fundamentally changed. So you need to fundamentally change. So it took us a little bit to realize that. But then as foreclosures started getting processed and there were, you know, so many houses that were coming on the market very inexpensively through bank REOs. And we did have some rentals at the time. Like I said, you know, anything that we fixed and tried to sell and couldn't for a while, we would rent. And those were all doing very well. Nobody was moving. I said, well, you know, and my dad was very hardcore against not renting. He did not want to be a landlord. He didn't want to manage tenants. And I said, I think this is where we need to go for right now. And so we started buying these houses for very cheap and renting them out. And that's fundamentally changed our business. So that's for several years, that's all we did. And that is really what changed my business. I would say we were buying 10 or 12 houses a year up to that point. And I think in 2011, that might have been the first year I bought 52. I was buying a house a week, and we did that for several years thereafter.
And in most of those situations, were most of those homes, that you kept and rented?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. And so then when you were going through that process, how did you, two thoughts I have. How did you get the financing to buy those 52 homes? What worked the best for you in that?
I used then, and I use now, private individuals, private investors. I don't think I've used my own money for anything since like 2002, 2003.
Okay.
So, I have money to use at this point, but I like, you know, when you're in real estate, you can use your money and you can go this far because your money is finite. No matter how much you have, it's finite. But when you've partnered and networked with other people, now it's unlimited.
Wow.
It's limited by how many people you know and can work with. That's the limitation at that point.
And I imagine there's many ways to partner with private investors as well. As they, you could have them just have a loan to you and you pay that whether you refinance and you pay them back out after a period of time, or they actually will become part owner in the deal with you as well. And so you have to put up less for that as well. There's multiple ways. What's worked best for you, do you think?
I typically offer a first mortgage on the house that I am purchasing. So the investor would be in a first mortgage holder. They would receive monthly interest only payments for X amount of time. Usually if I'm going to fix and sell the house, it's a 12-month period. If I'm going to hold and rent the house, it's a 24-month period.
Okay.
I have found that the and there are different peoples. There are some people that only want to lend on the fix and sells because they don't want their money out that long.
Right.
There are other people that don't want to lend at all on the fix and sells. They only want to be on the rentals because they don't want this money back. So, the people that typically lend on the rentals, even though we have just a 24-month note, they typically will renew and renew and renew, and then they get upset if I refinance or pay them off and I have to find a different property.
So you get to manage those people as well. So there's a lot of interconnected, you know, being able to communicate, connect, work through, realize you're going to have confrontations, but hopefully you work through those confrontations to a better end for both people kind of thing, recognizing those things. It takes some time and effort to for that, along just with understanding the deal itself. Would you say that it's imperative or important to know bank, you know, going back to that 08, 09, 2010 timeframe, was it important to have connections with bankers where you could get information about some of these homes that were coming out on foreclosures and things like that?
Not with bankers, because they had very specific regulations on they had to have the property listed, but relationships with realtors who were listing them, absolutely.
And how did you go about just building up those relationships with those real estate with those realtors?
Well, since I was making my money, my dad got his real estate license, so we would have access to the MLS. But I never used him for commission. We were making our money on the house, not on the commission. So if I found a house I liked, I could go straight to the listing agent and say, I'd like to buy this house. I'm not represented. You can have both sides of the commission. And all so now they're motivated to sell to me versus to somebody who's got their own realtor.
That's nice. So recognizing the benefit they get and utilizing that, hey, we can work together here. We both get something out of this, building up that network of people there as well. So then you progressed. You kept buying these homes. And again, I'm going to go back. It took years to do this and a changing business environment, especially caused by 08, 09, the economic calamity through that. But you start with one property, and then eventually you get to a point, and you're welcome to share as little or as much about this as you would like. You get to a point where somewhere down the road, and I forget what year it was, but you said, okay, I'm going to step away from this. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What year was that?
That was 2018.
2018. And so then you went along and built up these properties. And so here we are in a matter of 2 to 3 decades, right? Something like that. Two years. 18 years. Okay. Yeah. You at what, at that point, do you mind if I ask, how many properties did you all own that you were renting at that time?
We had about 320 doors. So some of them were single families, some of them were four families. I didn't have anything bigger than a four family. So I had 320, 25 doors.
Right. So you took what you were familiarity with, which was more the single family or smaller multi-family properties, and you just stuck with those, built those out, build them up, and over 18 years, now you have 350, a lot of properties. And it just took time. It took information. But as you said, and this is what I want everybody to hear, you didn't start out with a big chunk of money where you could come in and just buy this. You started out with one property and moved along, a real story of committing to an area that you knew could build wealth. And so then you wind up then packaging all these properties together. You sell them all, right? And then you step away from the real estate environment saying, like, I'm done with you. And
100%, because when we sold it, and you mentioned this in your book, we talked to our accountant and she said, you are going to have to do a 1031 exchange or you are going to have a 7-figure tax bill.
Wow.
And I said, that does not sound fun.
So the idea of you have all these single family homes, you can sell them as one project, but you're going to have this large gain. And as we talk a little bit about in the book, and of course you can find this information as well, a 1031 exchange done properly is a way to take the gain and there's it's more than just this, but basically we're going to take the gain, roll into a new piece of real estate and avoid having to pay taxes on that gain. And that then gets moved into the new property. So you then took all those single family homes and then wound up putting some, most or all, into a much larger property. Is that what you did?
That is correct. We did. Okay. We did the monopoly move. We traded our four houses for a hotel, except it wasn't a hotel. It was a 185 unit apartment building.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And so then, so you did that to avoid the taxes. Mm-hmm. Did you think at that point in time, I'm done, I'm just going to take the cash flow off of this. We'll have a property manager maybe run the 185 unit and be done. And what are you doing today?
You're going to laugh. I was done. I was done. I was done for a couple years.
That's right.
And then when did we start back up? We started back up in 2020, like right in like the beginning of COVID. So,
right.
We had been looking for additional multifamilies. I love the big multifamily. Right. I love it. It throws off a ton of cash flow. It's easy to manage, economy of scale. All the faucets are the same. It's all located in one spot. I love all of that. Now, breaking into that industry is harder. The commercial industry is like the wild, wild west of real estate. They don't have the regulations that residential does. Mm. They don't have the rules. They don't have a lot of it. So
you
really have to know who is selling and have those relationships and have the relationships with the banks, because you're not typically coming up with a private lender that's got $5 million that's going to lend you $5 million. So now you are working with banks. They have different lending criteria than they do for residential. Banks can be pretty finicky with what they want to work on and what they don't at those higher levels. So we had a couple properties under contract, nothing that actually went to fruition.
All right.
Let's go back to what we know. Mm-hmm. And we started buying more rentals, and we originally were going to be like, and my dad had retired several years before we even sold everything. So this was my husband and I said, let's just fix and sell. Let's just do one or two projects a year. We'll work on houses that we like. I like making them pretty, like old houses. We'll just do one or two a year.
Sure.
And we bought one, and then we bought one, and then we bought one. And then the wholesalers heard that I was buying again. So they're like, we've got rentals. And I was like, let's buy rentals. And so we are fixing and selling, and we have single family rentals. We have some apartment buildings, but I think 10 is our largest one that we bought.
Okay.
And we've added another 200 units since 2020. Yeah.
So you did the 1031 into a large residential property, or was it commercial? Okay. You did large residential. And then you started looking for, and I'm going to correct, just make sure I heard you correctly. Were you looking for the larger commercial or larger residential properties? Larger residential. And is that what you were saying is a little more like the wild, wild west?
All of commercial real estate, whether it's residential or warehouse or office buildings, it's all wild, wild west. Because they figure if you are an accredited investor, you don't need the protection that a homeowner
The smaller
needs.
Investor does. Right, yes. Right. Yeah. So you went back to doing what you're doing. So you went back to the single family homes. Do you mind if I ask how many you have right now in your portfolio?
Around we have the 185 units in Kentucky, and then we have about 200 in Ohio.
All right. So about 385 doors, as I would understand that well. So I'm going to get it out. I'm going to get out of this. Welcome back to it. And so when you stepped into it the second time, I mean, you're more seasoned. You knew you're gaining this knowledge all along the way. Has anything been easier for you getting back into it? Or is it still just the recognition of you got to put your work in, you're going to get surprises, you have to be prepared for the surprises, but that's all a part of this process, right? Nothing's easy, but it may be worth it, but it just requires some work and effort.
Yes. There are some things that are easier than when I first got started. I still have my wholesaler and realtor connections for deals.
Okay. All right.
I still have my private lender connections. So I still have easy access to money. The tenants and the contractors are still as difficult as they have ever been and ever will be.
Sure.
You know, so there's that. I mean, it's,
There is the fear of real estate investors that people want to get into it is they always say, you know, I'll use the often referenced, I don't want to have to go unclog a toilet at midnight if I'm the one managing the property. And that while that's an overblown story, I'll say, but it does happen as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it doesn't happen. So just there is work involved. And so I would say between your husband and you, if you're married, you almost both have to buy into this process that we're going to do this because of the unknowns that come up. Because it could interfere we're planning a day out at the park, and all of a sudden this could come up, right? And if one's into it and one's not, that could create some friction there, I would imagine.
That it could absolutely create friction. In fact, and I don't know if you know this, I was married before. I had a first marriage. I got married when I was 25. So I had already started my real estate business. I was still working as a bartender. I wasn't like fabulously wealthy and independent and all of that, struggling to, you know, run a business when I got married, and my husband knew we were in this. And, probably within a year, just the risk that came with it and the not constant, I didn't have a constant paycheck. I'd have giant paychecks and then I'd have nothing for who knows how long until the next giant paycheck. That was difficult for him. Ultimately I think was what kind of ended our marriage. I was married for 18 months. And you know, we kind of parted ways at that point. Now my, you know, current husband, we've been married a long time now, and he's very risk tolerant and fairly laid back. And I wouldn't say he does do the business with me, but, he, you know, was also sick for several years. So he ended up having a kidney transplant last year. So he was on dialysis for a year and doing different things, and he wasn't helping with the business at all, but he did understand if I needed to step out and take a phone call on Saturday, you know, so that was there. So I don't think you have to have a partner that does it with you, but they have to understand that there is risk and reward. But you know,
as long as they're there to support you and being involved in that, you want at least that. If it's someone that's like, I don't want you buying that. I don't know why you're buying that for family and this and that. I think I would probably stop right there, and I would not. You want to have some connection there, I would say. And I think you agree with that then as well. So as we're getting to the end here, so here's again, I love your story. I just love how you got started, because anybody could learn from this. Anybody could do this if they want to put the time and attention and have the wherewithal to go into this particular asset class or super asset classes that I referenced in. So here I am, and it doesn't really matter if I'm 22 or 35, or maybe even 50, like your dad, getting started in this. You can do it at any age. What advice would you give to someone right now looking to start investing in real estate today? Is it getting the connections, getting the information, maybe going to their first RIA meeting? Just start pulling in all the information you can. What advice would you give them?
I would say start meeting people. Go to your first RIA meeting. Also, I would say figure out what you want real estate to do for you. Do you want cash flow? Do you want write-offs? Do you want, you know, giant chunks of cash? Because different strategies have different benefits that go with that. And you might not be on the same page as, you know, my dad. He wanted cash flow. I wanted chunks. You know, we had to work that out. So figure out what you want real estate to do for you. And then figure out what strategies will provide that for you. So if you need 20 grand and you need 20 grand like now, don't buy a rental. That's not going to happen for you.
Right.
You know?
Right.
If you're looking at building up your retirement, then yeah, buy rentals, you know?
Yeah.
And that'll be good. So figure out what you want to do and then focus on that. When I first got started, one of the problems I had was that there were so many different ways to make money in real estate.
Right.
And they all sounded wonderful. And I said, I will do whatever it takes. I will do any deal. I will do whatever it takes. I will make the deal happen.
Right.
And that was a bad idea because it was, I liken it to like digging for oil. I dug a whole bunch of 1 foot holes and didn't find anything. You know, you have to stay and go deep, become an expert at something, make connections at something. And then when you've mastered that technique, learn the next one. But don't try to learn all of them at the same time because you will just be treading water and you won't get anywhere.
So do your homework in making connections, maybe attend a first REIA meeting. Do your homework in understanding the different strategies you could use in real estate and what might best fit your life and what you're looking for, and then go deep with that strategy and learn that one as well as possible before you decide to go into another strategy. That's kind of what I heard you saying. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Great. All right. So as we're wrapping up here, I ask everybody this question. It is called the Transformational Wealth Podcast. When you hear that term transformational wealth, what does that mean to you?
That means to me, you know, you hear transformational, things have to change.
Right.
And wealth is a tool. It's not a destination.
Right.
So when I was younger, I thought it was a destination. And then when 2018 happened and I reached that destination, it's like, what do I do with my life now?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because, you know, I had this path, get there. And then I got to the destination and now what? I mean, yeah, it's like buying a new car. It's really cool for a little bit. And then the novelty of it wears off.
Right.
So the wealth is a tool. It'd be like getting very excited about getting a hammer and you're going to be excited. What are you doing with that hammer? So what are you doing with the wealth? And that I think is the transformational piece. So what I have found is that it's given me freedom of time, freedom to explore life in the way that I want to explore it. So if I want to learn how to grow wheat, which I'm learning how to grow wheat right now, I'm going to learn how to grow wheat. You know, why? Because I want to. I want to learn how to do that. You know, why do I want to learn? I don't know. That brings me joy. What brings you joy? You know, you should be doing things that bring you joy and let the wealth be the tool that you do to find joy in your life and to serve other people.
So it sounds like, and I appreciate you mentioning that because I hear that from a lot of people, that wealth aspect, the financial wealth, I'll say is kind of the lowest form of wealth. There's these other forms of wealth of like, you know, and I've said this before, wisdom, purpose, freedom of time, freedom of money, things like that. And in fact, what you're able to do is maybe if there are things that, let's say some people think, I want to do this, but I have to wait till after retirement to do this. What you're able to do with this right now is take those things, bring them back into today and get to experience those today while you're still doing your work with your real estate. And that real estate business, how you've done that, has given you the opportunity to be able to experience those freedoms, which is the transformational piece for you out of this?
Yes. The transformational piece has totally been, you know, identifying what brings my life joy and spending my time there. And
awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. No, I appreciate that answer. I love that answer. I agree with you 100% as well. And well, we're at the end of our time. Thank you so much, Alyssa Miller, for joining us on this the Transformational Wealth Podcast, talking about real estate. Again, thank you to our sponsor, Harvest Financial Advisors, harvestadvisors.com. And you can find more resources and more information on my websites, markhen.com and powerplaysofthewealthy.com. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope this has been very helpful and launches you into your next thing. And I look forward to hearing about your power plays that come about. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Transformational Wealth Podcast with Mark Henn. Mark is devoted to helping you understand how the wealthy invest and explaining how to leverage investment strategies to make the most of your financial situation. Are you ready to leverage the power plays and attain financial freedom? Visit markhenn.com to tap into the power plays of the wealthy to start building your financial future today.